Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And it all comes down to the content of understanding because of our illiteracy on the Constitution. I just can't. It's hard for me to sit here and watch America literally go through this. It's like watching a train wreck in ultra slow motion. As different cars spin, twist, contort, coming off the rail, things flying out. I mean, the carnage and the mayhem is just overwhelming. And I say that, folks, because we're constantly seeking because I was just talking with Tammy. Welcome back, Tammy. We've got Tammy today with us. And so Sean is off having a separate Valentine's Day or what have you with his wife. And that's great. So this carnage, this mayhem, let's shift back to that, because we don't want to think about love and harmony and that type of stuff. We want to think about mayhem. And because apparently, if it leads, it bleeds. Apparently, if people start visualizing what the heck's going on and how we're being manipulated, unfortunately, because of our illiteracy, we're being led by a crew, a large, vast, independent, I'll call them preachers. I came in my mind, I see this metaphorical projection of what is today, what we're dealing with today. I shouldn't say nobody. I know I am literally going through the content that you need to understand so that you understand the Constitution and place constitutional context to everything, not some witty soundbite that's coming from all of the different great sources out there that I will call the preachers standing on their soapboxes that give us the soundbite of the day in response to what the progressives are doing to us and what the globalists and the communists and this vast global conspiracy that has been succeeding day after day, year after year. We're this close to the brink. And still, there's so few people that are waking up because we choose to regurgitate the soundbite that we're hearing from our favorite preachers of patriotism and conservatism and whatever isms you want to add to this. But the reality is, folks, if you're not placing constitutional context, as a matter of fact, I reached out on social media, and I'm going to mention her name, because it's kind of that important. So let me pull it up because I have to look at my activity log. And I say that because I kind of lost where we were, what I had said, or who I was saying it to. And I'm sure hope I still got that activity log. Yep, there it is. Nope, that's not it. Well, anyway, I can come up with a name. She's a young kid. I think she might be a lawyer, but she's trying to become a Candace Owens or Charlie Kirk or that person that, you know, gives you, you know, here's the problem and gives you a soundbite. And I think her soundbite today is being regurgitated by a lot of people, where you see the little video of Schumer with his hair calling for more ID enforcement and requirements on people getting welfare back when he had hair. And I think, well, okay, maybe the takeaway that everybody's missing is maybe when Schumer had hair, he had more logic and was able to think. And maybe we just need to give him more hair. Let's give him his hair back so he'll stop being so stupid. But that's not really what we need to focus on. What we need to focus on constitutionally is the fact that the Senate is obligated, every senator in the U.S. Senate is obligated to vote in accordance with the state legislature. He's on this mission and his own agenda, not his own agenda. He is supporting the globalist agenda. So I was articulating to this young lady that if the state legislature demanded their suffrage, which they constitutionally have, and folks, I wrote this article a while back called The Truth About the 17th Amendment and what would happen if the state legislature actually took back their suffrage, that today we would have 62, if not 64, Republican state house votes locked down and give Trump that SAVE Act, not having to worry about the filibuster. The filibuster is a protection from changing the Senate into mob rule. And I'm telling you what, the progressives and the globalists are just smacking their lips wanting to see that happen. But I'm telling you that today, even looking at how far advanced their agenda and the globalists have had over the Senate, we still have this demanding, this huge demand and control over the Senate if we were using the Constitution. And 5 years ago, it was even more than this because we wouldn't have to start flipping seats. 10 years ago is when they started stealing seats out of Arizona because McCain died. And because, you know, these problems in Georgia and Alabama, so forth and so on. If we look at the 17th Amendment and we look at the state legislature, the Constitution, and the awareness and the application of following the Constitution would solve this problem in the Senate. And I say this is so important because the day will come when the Senate will be actually ratifying a treaty to get rid of the Constitution. That's coming. And if we don't seize control over that Senate, we're all going to believe that what they're doing is legitimate. Just like these refugees treaties. Bringing refugees into the United States using treaties is not legitimate. That's why we go through this content. They can only make treaties regarding those enumerated powers. There's no enumerated power for the federal government to be involved in the importation of persons or immigration. They only have the responsibility of making a uniform rule of naturalization. It was clearly pointed out by Thomas Jefferson and even in the Constitution that the federal government was not to control the state's immigration. And the states can actually import refugees if they want to. They just can't import slaves anymore because of the 1808 clause in the Constitution.
Again, is there even a method available for them to import?
Well, so the states have to do, if they wanted to, and so this is where the other states, this is, you know, we're going to dive into a little swimming hole here. So there are some progressive states that would want to bring people in that would be deemed as enemies and so forth and so on. And so even though that state may bring them in, every state that surrounds them or surrounding them, those other states, let's look at all the Western states as enemies of the Constitution. And they may be bringing in MS-13 and so forth. So all of those states that are bordering them could literally demand that the federal government, because these states are bringing in these things, they could demand that the federal government identify these types of people, Islamists and drug cartel and or people from these different countries, that they cannot immigrate to the United States because these countries possess a high threat to the United States. In other words, the federal government has the responsibility of national security, right?
Right.
And they can determine whether we're doing open trade or what have you. And they can call upon these state heads, you know, whether that be Honduras or El Salvador, Nicaragua, Panama, doesn't matter, Colombia, Venezuela. I should have stuck with it doesn't matter because I keep on listening. Doesn't matter which, they have the authority to say, these countries are harboring absolute terrorists that if we allowed these people to come to America, then they would be a real problem. And so we're denying the migration or importation of any of these people from these nations. That is the federal government's true responsibility. And the court has completely flipped us upside down, saying, no, they can't do that. No, anybody and everybody has a right to come here to destroy us. If they don't like us, they can just come here, migrate, and destroy us. And they have the right of due process, and we're going to do everything we can to protect them.
Right.
I mean, this is how insane. This is how insane it is. The court, I'm stuttering here, I'm seething. The court has been the true undermining of our constitutional republic. Because what they did was they perverted our republic into a judiciary form of government. And they've got everybody believing and buying into they possess all the authority and have the ultimate say. No, the states have the ultimate say over all those things that are not delegated to them. And all those things that are delegated to the federal government or the branches of the federal government, where the executive has the ability to identify, you know, what states are threats to us and what states aren't. Now, I can tell you that if we had a communist in the White House, like Obama, he was purely a communist. Biden, a communist puppet. I mean, the guy didn't even have any gray matter between his ears to actually really cognitively think for himself. And I'm not even saying in his old age he was that way when he got into the Senate. I mean, this guy couldn't even, I mean, he was accused of plagiarism in some of his work.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this guy that was elected was such a dolt that he was told what he had to do. And he was a diligent minion doing exactly what they wanted him to do. So I could see Biden and I could see Clinton and I can even see the Bushes, how, you know, they were aligned with allowing bad people. I mean, who was the president that started allowing the apportionment of illegals to be counted for representation? Now, anybody thinking, if they know the history of the census, because the census is where we keep track of, you know, all the people in the United States. If anybody knows, they would know that Carter, during his administration, opened up the census to actually account for and keep track of everybody here. Immigrants, illegals, doesn't matter if you're here and they talk to you, they just want to know that you're here and are you a U.S. citizen. And then once they know that you're a U.S. citizen, they actually gather more information on the U.S. citizen and move forward. But the illegals at that point and other people that weren't citizens weren't apportioned for representation. In 1990, it was George H.W. Bush that said, we will provide representation for every person here, which is how California got a huge realignment in the 90s of upping their representation. And how, from that point on, the gates of hell have been opened, allowing every, you know, creature, good and evil, to come across our southern border. And that the federal government was actually down there providing propaganda. Hey, just cross our border and we'll embrace you. The State Department under Obama was doing just that. Literally using the embassy to say, hey, don't worry about immigrating. Just get across the border. If you can get across the border, we will embrace you. You, your family, and every derelict that you could bring with you. So, and anyway, I know I'm using a little salty language or getting close to that. So let me get back to this. The point is this, is that the states could, on their own, bring in true refugees, like the refugees of Vietnam. True war refugees, of true people that, by coming here, they've actually made America better. Because their ideals and their love of liberty. But when you start bringing in enemies like Mohammedans that want to actually convert America into Islam and Sharia law and hadiths and caliphates, blah, 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 I mean, all these bad, evil things to take away our liberty and subjugate us, if not kill us. And or the Chinese who wants to dominate the entire world. There's all sorts of people that want to destroy the last beacon of liberty in the world. All sorts of nations and people. But I believe that when you look at the nations themselves, like China, there's no doubt in my mind there are more people in China that want their liberty than that want to crush the United States. And a lot of them were very disappointed that Mr. Globalist George H.W. Bush sat on his hands and did nothing when Tiananmen Square went down. Sat on his hands, and we sat on our hands when Hong Kong fell. And we've sat on our hands when every other nation fell. Instead of changing our paradigm and saying, we're getting out of the UN, we're no longer part of this globalist crap, we're done. If you want to be a nation of liberty, you need, as the people of your nation, need to call for an election, not for an election of a leader, but an election to become a state in the United States. Because the only way we're going to protect you, we're not coming in to change regimes, and we're not coming to protect you from yourselves anymore. You elect, you know, an Atola that wants to convert you and subjugate you, then that's what you get. Or you allow the radicals to do that. But it's not our responsibility to do anything other than bring those in who want to become a part of this constitutional republic, this hybrid constitutional republic of liberty. So that's it. That would be, we would not even be fighting in foreign wars. But we would be ready to defend ourselves to literally wipe out everybody if they cross the line. Because that right there costs nothing to keep on ramping up and having superior firepower. For the most part, and this is some of the things that just really infuriated me. When I looked at how we sat on our laurels by just adding, you know, warheads to the arsenal over the 70s and 80s, instead of continuing to truly beef up and improve and innovate, I remember going through boot camp in the 70s and getting out in the 90s, we were still using similar uniforms and technology for troop protection and so forth. As a matter of fact, Clinton did nothing to upgrade, you know, we had some improvements with cavalry, but Clinton's administration did nothing. There was a complete stagnation in protecting the troops and in protecting, you know, the actual combat or the combatant, you know, the boots on the ground. And they did that because they didn't care. You know, there were things in the pipeline of new aircraft and those types of things. But they were not invigorating American defense and innovation in defending itself. What did the Clintons do? The Clintons were giving China secrets. They were giving them the nuclear power secrets out of Los Alamos. They were giving them the missile technology out of the Loral Corporation that then became a part of Martin Marietta. And when they brought in the Loral Corporation into Martin Marietta, we called them Low Morale. So, you know, just playing with the company names and putting them together. Anyway, so bottom line. Bottom line, when we look at the states and the states' power, the federal government and the states could actually force any of these progressive states from being able to do what they do. If Biden and Clinton and so forth, these presidents wanted to actually allow these other states by changing the status of these nations, they couldn't do that without Congress. And so if we maintained the control over the Senate, because in every single period, even today, the Senate, the United States Senate, would be hard red, because that's how many hard red states there are. We're not as – I mean, there may be a mass population in these huge population centers that are in a few states. But how did they get control of the Senate? Because the 17th Amendment misaligned and incorrectly perverted what the 17th Amendment did. Everybody completely misinterpreted it, and long story short, there's no way we would be in this state, because the states would still be able to control that Senate and not allow those types of things to occur, to changing the security and the standards, because the Senate actually has this check on the president with his emissaries and those types of things, because they're the ones that want to make sure that the nation's security, the trade and everything else is being properly done to protect the state's interest. That's why when you read in Article 2, you'll find that the Senate actually has responsibilities to keep the president in check. The advice and consent of the Senate, I think, comes up a few times. Anyway, we digress. We are covering Madison's notes on the Constitutional Convention, and today's a very important day. And, oh, by the way, the whole reason I went down this whole path and why Tammy just said, hey, there's some water over here, G.R., why don't you go swimming? The whole point is we need to continue to learn, we need to continue to pray, and we need to continue to act in being champions on the Constitution. The more we understand the Constitution and what we should be doing, that helps predicate how we're to act. So, we're covering in the Constitutional Convention Madison's notes on, it's 75, I got Hamilton's plan. And so, and I want to make sure that it would be 75. Yeah, I think, yeah, it should be on 75 for you. At the very top, Hamilton's plan, and it's Mr. Hamilton, where he starts and he goes into this very long oration. And it's a long oration. And the reason we're going to go through every word of this is I want everybody to hear and understand what this pernicious person was asserting as the direction of the nation, in his eyes, the proper direction this nation needed to go. Completely different from everything else. So if there was a complete contrast, or I should say something that was antithetical to what they were doing, Hamilton did it and he poked everybody in the eye because he was that arrogant. Anyway, so we're going to start with that, with Mr. Hamilton. And by the way, if something stands out, feel free to just stop and say, hey, okay, you know, let's talk about that. Or I will do my usual and be the mean interrupter. We've got about 1.5 minutes. So actually, why don't we wait till we come back from the break to chew on this?
Okay.
So what I said regarding the national security requirements that the executive has, the controls that the Senate has over the executive in appointing and changing the ambassadors, and even in changing the ambassador's, let's call it, tone of the messaging that we want to have as a nation, that we want to embrace these drug runners, these anti-constitution, you know, Mohammedans, blah, 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 then if the president actually wants to bring, because there needs to be a standing policy, this probably needs to be written in big, bold letters, so that no matter where you are in the body of the whole, in the full Chamber of Commerce, Congress, where both the Senate, the Supreme Court, where, you know, the president does his address, in big, bold letters, that the federal government's responsibility is to protect the sovereignty of the union and the sovereignty of the individual states. Therefore, when the president wants to actually start embracing enemies and allowing enemies to come here safely, then Congress needs to impeach that the president. They need to say, you have crossed the line, you are failing to protect our sovereignty, you're failing to protect the individual sovereignty as well as the sovereignty of the union, the individual sovereignty of the states. So by doing that, as a matter of fact, this is where Congress could literally start taking the tone and identifying what are the true threats. And the states need to be far more involved, because we should have a bottom-up movement. We should have a bottom-up system. We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so with that, I threw that last comment out there. There's no doubt in my mind, we are to have a self-governing system. And the best way is to literally and clearly articulate. Today, we have so many enemies within the United States. The only thing that's protecting us, folks, is the oath of the citizen. And I say that because the oath of the citizen demands that every citizen support the Constitution above all. Support and defend the Constitution above all enemies, foreign and domestic. Therefore, any citizen that is out there demanding the stopping of the repelling of invaders, every single citizen out there, I've said this time and time again, too bad our conservative entertainers than giving us the sound bites of the day, too bad they're not saying we have the right to strip these people of their citizenship. But why is that not being said? Oh, well, shoot. We would be on the path of solving the problem. Boy, having those people out there gives me something to say. Having an enemy and having us going down into the sink, you know, going into the cesspool, America falling, I get money out of that. I'm getting rich. Are you kidding me? It's almost like the heroin addict poking his arm again or her arm and saying, yeah, I'm in control. I could stop it, but I don't have to have my next one. I don't have to, but I choose to. And I'm going to have another one because I can stop at any time. So anyway, all right. Well, so yeah. Hopefully that all makes sense. And hopefully, are you ready to dive into Hamilton now?
I am.
All right, great. Go ahead.
It's a long one.
Yep.
All right. Mr. Hamilton had been hitherto silent on the business before the convention, partly from respect to others whose superior abilities, age, and experience rendered him unwilling to bring forward ideas dissimilar to theirs, and partly from his delicate situation with respect to his own state, whose sentiments, as expressed by his colleagues, he could by no means accede.
Okay, so I'm going to interrupt you already. Madison already sets the tone. He says that he was unwilling... him unwilling to bring forward ideas dissimilar to theirs. Right there, mm-hmm. He's basically saying, you know, I didn't want to become the contrarian because you guys are all wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So remember, Hamilton is saying a lot of stuff. And Madison's taking notes, but I believe that this beginning sentence kind of speaks to what he took away from what Hamilton was saying. Because he basically led us to, you know, Hamilton is going to be providing us with a dissimilar view and a path forward of, you know, where we need to go. Anyway, go ahead.
Okay. The crisis, however, which now marked our affairs, was too serious to permit any scruples whatever to prevail over the duty imposed on every man to contribute his efforts for the public safety and happiness. He was obliged, therefore, to declare himself unfriendly to both plans. He was particularly opposed to that from New Jersey, being fully convinced that no amendment of the Confederation leaving the states in possession of their sovereignty could possibly answer the purpose. On the other hand, he confessed he was much discouraged by the amazing extent of country and expecting the desired blessings from any general sovereignty that could be substituted. As to the powers of the convention, he thought the doubt started on that subject had arisen from distinctions and reasonings too subtle. A federal government, he conceived, to mean an association of independent communities into one. Different confederacies have different powers and exercise them in different ways. In some instances, the powers are exercised over collective bodies and others over individuals, as in the German Diet and among ourselves in cases of piracy. Great latitude, therefore, must be given to the signification of the term. The plan last proposed departs itself from the federal idea as understood by some, since it is to operate eventually on individuals. He agreed, moreover, with the honorable gentleman from Virginia,
Mr. Randolph,
that we owed it to our country to do on this emergency whatever we should deem essential to its happiness. The state sent us here to provide for the exigencies mm-hmm. of the Union. To rely on and propose any plan not adequate to these exigencies merely because it was not clearly within our powers would be to sacrifice the means to the end. It may be said that the states cannot ratify a plan not within the purview of the Article of Confederation, providing for alterations and amendments. But may not the states themselves, in which no constitutional authority equal to this purpose exists in the legislatures, have had in view a reference to the people at large? Go down a little bit. In the Senate of New York, a proviso was moved that no act of the convention should be binding until it should be referred to the people and ratified, and the motion was lost by a single voice only, the reason assigned against it being that it might possibly be found an inconvenient shackle.
Ah, okay, so what he just showed here was the state of New York came close to creating a shackle on the delegates coming from New York. So they made sure that they weren't constrained. But if they sent delegates that would be of the opinion of that close majority, in other words, those that wanted to constrain it, then they themselves would come with a constrained paradigm and say, hey, we can't do this. We're not going to do this. Because not that they're following the state's scope of the commission that was given them, they're following their hearts of the that motion that was lost in the Senate that he points to. They say, well, we were of the opinion that that should have passed, but it lost by one vote. So we're not going to move forward. And in other words, they undermined what the true commission that was passed by a majority. Now, I'm not a fan of democracies, but I'm telling you folks, when it comes that close and to find an ideologue that goes against it, this is where people that really believe that they're more important than, you know, who they represent in a Republican form of government, because I can't emphasize enough, I see this all the time, where we put aside this paradigm that we're a Republican form of government. And what we have is a bunch of dukes, duchesses, princes and princesses, and we have, you know, kings and queens and all these self-made monarchs and aristocracies, groups and oligarchies, all fighting for a piece of the pie. Just like we have all these conservative entertainers over there entertaining us on what the heck's going on so that we're none the wiser. The chaos is being created because we're not functioning in the government we're supposed to be operating in. And that was the same problem there because they sent ideologues into, and that's why Livermore and Lansing, I believe if I look up their names, they both start with L, from New York, these other two delegates, these were hardcore anti-federalists. They did not want to see anything other than some suggested amendments. Heck, you know, at that point, the convention, and maybe at the very beginning, they should have handed out all eight amendments and said, here are amendments that we can send back to the states right now. And now, but let's offer a, you know, and create a plan that we can offer a better option. That way they would say, okay, well, we already know that these amendments fell flat. And so what's the point? Because it would force them to eat those amendments. Lansing and, those two delegates from New York, the anti-federalists, they would have been just as good eating those amendments because they know that it wasn't about improving the Articles of Confederation. The anti-federalists were protecting the cabal. They were protecting the seat of power that the state had gained under the Articles of Confederation. The same thing was going on in New York with Patrick Henry, Clinton up in New York. But it wasn't Hancock up in Massachusetts. So when we saw some of these different powerful states, you know, reason started prevailing, common sense, logic, and reason. So anyway, I'm sorry for interrupting, but he's exposing, you know, the what really happened behind the scenes. This flies again in the face of the John Birchers saying that they were tied hard. They weren't. They weren't. Hamilton comes out and says they lost that put by one vote in the state. So even though men may have came and had this opinion, their opinions, you know, there's an old saying about opinions and people's backsides, that they both stink. They have no merit on the facts. The majority ruled that they were to come with a blank check, and New York sent three delegates to be blank check supporters. But they weren't. But Hamilton himself was a problem, and this is why we're going to read this. So keep going. Thank you.
Okay. The great question is, what provision shall we make for the happiness of our country? You would first make a comparative examination of the two plans, prove that there were essential defects in both, and point out such changes as might render a national one efficacious. The great and essential principles necessary for the support of government are, 1, an active and constant interest in supporting it. This principle does not exist in the states in favor of the federal government. They have evidently, in a high degree,
esprit de corps.
Esprit de corps.
Esprit de corps.
Esprit de corps.
Uh-huh.
They constantly pursue internal interests adverse to those of the whole. They have their particular debts, their particular plans of finance, etc. And all these, when opposed to, invariably prevail over the requisitions and plans of Congress.
Okay.
2, the love of power. Men love power. The same remarks are applicable to this principle. The states have constantly shown a disposition rather to regain the powers delegated by them than to part with more or to give effect to what they had parted with. The ambition of their demagogues is known to hate the control of the general government. It may be remarked, too, that the citizens have not that anxiety
to...
Hold on, I just lost my spot.
Okay.
I scrolled up too quickly.
All right.
That
the citizens have not that anxiety to prevent a dissolution of the general government as of the particular governments.
It may be remarked, too, that the citizens have not that anxiety to prevent a dissolution of the general government as of the particular government. Mm-hmm. A dissolution of the latter would be fatal. Of the former would still leave the purposes of government attainable to a considerable degree. Consider what such a state as Virginia will be in a few years, a few compared to the life of nations. How strongly will it feel its importance and self-sufficiency? 3, a habitual attachment of the people. The whole force of this tie is on the side of the state government. Its sovereignty, it's immediately before the eyes of the people. Its protection is immediately enjoyed by them. From its hand distributive justice, and all those acts which familiarize and endear government to a people who are dispensed to them. Four, force by which may be understood a coercion of laws or coercion of arms. Congress have not the former, except in a few cases. In particular states, this coercion is nearly sufficient, though he held it in most cases, not entirely so. A certain portion of military force is absolutely necessary in large communities. Massachusetts, I'm assuming that's what that stands for.
Uh-huh.
Massachusetts is now feeling this necessity and making provision for it. But how can this force be exerted on the states collectively? It is impossible. It amounts to a war between the parties. Foreign powers also will not be idle spectators. They will interpose. The confusion will increase, and a dissolution of the Union ensue. Five, influence. He did not mean corruption, but a dispensation of those regular honors and emoluments which produce an attachment to the government. Almost all the weight of these is on the side of the states and must continue so long as the states continue to exist. All the passions then we see of avarice, ambition, interests which govern most individuals and all public bodies fall into the current of the states and do not flow in the stream of the general government.
Okay, right there.
Former.
Okay.
Okay, go ahead.
So, five. Influence. He did not mean corruption, i.e., when people were using money to buy the government and so forth, but a dispensation of those regular honors and emoluments. In other words, a league of lawyers who are above us all because they receive the emolument of the bar, that they are a part and an officer of the legal system of the land. Not that they're voted. Not that they're elected by the people to be a legal officer of the land. They, on their own, go and learn the law and, by the bar testing, become a diligent soldier in participating and protecting the legal system, which means that they're protecting the legal system, not the liberties, rights, and the Constitution. This is why later on, the real 13th Amendment, which was considered the nobility amendment, that kept people from being able to be a citizen if you were a part of the bar. They didn't want anybody with this type of what he's talking about, these honors and emoluments, to produce such an attachment. These people create the attachment to the government because it's a government that is elevating them. In other words, instead of, you know, being corrupted because you're getting rich, everybody is, you know, starting to support the government, or at least those people with the knowledge, and they become the affluent, not the affluencers, but the influencers, if that makes sense. So we see,
yeah, and they're getting the emoluments.
Right, and he goes down and he says this. All the passions then we see of avarice, which is greed, ambition, interest, which govern most individuals and all public bodies, fall into the current of the states. In other words, like the current of the rivers, the energies of the states, and do not flow in the streams of the general government. Okay, so that's where we left off. And so he's making the point that right here, the states have these energies. The states have, and he's actually speaking favorable of the idea of bringing people to becoming in love with their government because it elevates what he would consider the good core of the people. Not corrupt, because he started off, he says, influence, not that he meant corruption, but a dispensation of those regular honors and emoluments. Those were good things in his mind. In Hamilton's mind, those were good things that we wanted to build upon, that he wanted to build upon with his argument. So now go ahead.
Okay. The former, therefore, will generally be an overmatch for the general government and render any confederacy in its very nature precarious. Theory is, in this case, fully confirmed by experience. How do you say that word?
The Amphicontic, I think, is something like that. Amphicontic Council.
Amphicontic Council had, it would seem, ample powers for general purposes. It had, in particular, the power of finding and using force against delinquent members. What was the consequence? Their degrees were mere signals of war. The Phocian War is a striking example of it. Philip, at length, taking advantage of their disunion and insinuating himself into their councils, made himself master of their fortunes. The German Confederacy affords another lesson. The authority of Charlemagne seemed to be as great as could be necessary. The great feudal chiefs, however, exercising their local sovereignties, soon felt the spirit and found the means of encroachments which reduced the imperial authority to a nominal sovereignty. The Diet has succeeded, which, though aided by a prince at its head of great authority independently of his imperial attributes, is a striking illustration of the weakness of confederated government.
Okay, so from the Amphicontic Council, which is ancient Greece, into the German confederations or confederacies of the authority of Charlemagne. You probably heard of Charlemagne. He's going through the historical lessons that have been learned by these confederations and the problems that exist within them. And that's why he says, other examples instruct us in the same truth. Right? So go ahead.
Mm-hmm. The Swiss cantons have scarce any union at all and have been more than once at war with one another. How then are all these evils to be avoided? Only by such a complete sovereignty in the general government. As will turn all the strong principles and passions above mentioned on its side. Does the scheme of New Jersey produce this effect? Does it afford any substantial remedy whatever? On the contrary, it labors under great defects, and the defect of some of its provisions will destroy the efficacy of others. It gives a direct revenue to Congress, but this will not be sufficient. The balance can only be supplied by requisitions, which experience proves cannot be relied on. If states are to deliberate on the mode, they will also deliberate on the object of the supplies and will grant or not grant as they approve or disapprove of it. Delinquency of one will invite and countenance in it others. Quotas, too, must, in the nature of things, be so unequal as to produce the same evil. What standard will you resort? Land is a fallacious one. Compare Holland with Russia, France or England with other countries of Europe, Pennsylvania with North Carolina. Will the relative pecuniary abilities in those instances correspond with the relative value of land? Take numbers of inhabitants for the rule and make like comparison of different countries, and you will find it to be equally unjust.
Okay.
The different degrees of industry. Go ahead.
Okay, so we're just kind of hold off on the different degrees of industry. Okay. Up above, he made a comment because he went through this history, right? And then he kind of went on other examples. This was the beginning of a look at what he was offering, because he says other, and it's right here in the very first line, or the next line. Other examples instruct us in the same truth. The Swiss cantons have scarce any union at all, and have been more than once at war with one another. How then are these evils to be avoided? Only by such a complete sovereignty in the general government. What he is talking about is a federation, not a republic, or not a confederation republic, which is what we have. Well, the outcome of the Constitutional Convention created a confederation, We've gone through this before, right? The difference between a federation and a confederation. So I'm going to test you to just embarrass you, since we've gone through this so many times in front of the audience here. I'm just kidding. Oh boy, if we had video, I'd probably, you know, every once in a while I'd probably see Tammy sweat. And I'm just kidding, folks. I know that all of this stuff is maybe complicated. It's really not. The simple way to understand a federation from a confederation in a federal government. Both have a federal government, what we call a federal government, or aptly, the appropriate term would be a general government. However, in a federation, it truly is a federal government, because the federal government is, and the federation is, the general government. What that means is, in a federation, all the powers are vested in that central general government. It becomes the the sovereign state instead of a union of sovereign states. And the individual states are granted ancillary powers and or responsibilities for administrative purposes. That's what he's talking about here. He's talking about a complete sovereignty in the general government by creating a federation. Now, did we succeed in doing that? Heck no. And everybody, when we talk in this level, I get everybody to agree, no, we have a very limited and defined general government, which is the essence of a confederation, where all residual powers of government, you know, are retained by the county, or by the, not the counties, by the states and the people. And inside the states, it should be by the counties and the people. In other words, we want to make sure that the residual mass of powers of government are closest to the people, not, you know, in some bureaucracy across the seas or, you know, 5,000 miles away. Government rules us best when we rule ourselves. And we've created a system that creates limited powers at the national level, limited powers at the state level, and can have limited or quasi whatever we want at the county level, because you can get in your car or actually get on a bicycle and ride to the county offices and say, hey, how dare you do these things? Because now we have full accountability. They can't hide. The America just can't descend upon the capital of the United States or the world very easily, especially back then. So a confederation is where you have a general government that has very limited and defined powers. Now, we're running out of time, so I just want to leave it with this. Do we have a confederation or a federation? Clearly, we have a confederation. So why is it that I hear conservatives all the time using the word federalism? Federalism is basically asserting that we have a federation. So with that, we'll dive back into federalism when we have Tammy back, because we should have Sean tomorrow and then Tammy and Sean. That's the way it'll be working if everything works. And so we'll wait till Tammy comes back to dive into federalism so that we, you know, close the gap and actually bring Sean into this. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model, on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.